From the nation's capital, for National Public Radio, this is Josh Dorsa speaking to you from the Opera House of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. In a moment, another in the continuing series of national town meetings will be getting underway. The topic of this town meeting, the American future. The principal speakers will be commentator James J. Kilpatrick and author David Halberstam. Following the initial presentations, members of the audience will have the opportunity to present questions to the speakers. These national town meetings are aimed at presenting distinguished figures from various fields, discussing with you, our radio audience, and with the audience assembled here at the Kennedy Center, some of the most important issues of the day and of the future. And now, the moderator of today's national town meeting, Nicholas von Hoffman.
The national town meeting will be in session. Ladies and gentlemen, we're very lucky to have two of our finest journalists and writers here to talk to us today. I'm sure that you have heard and read and seen James J. Kilpatrick on CBS television, on radio. He writes one of America's most famous newspaper columns called Conservative Viewpoint. In some 320 newspapers. He's an old friend of mine, and I may say that he's not one of the usual kinds of conservatives. He's a civilized conservative. He's also humane, witty, the author of 5 books, a busy man, and a credit to our business. As is our second speaker, David Halberstam, who is most famous for his book, The Best and the Brightest, the story of what brought us into Vietnam. Before that, Dave was a distinguished reporter for the New York Times. He has been a contributing editor to Harper's Magazine. He has written another book, The Making of a Quagmire, which warned us not to do it. Is also one of the people that I think everyone in the news business respects the most and looks to for setting a standard. May I introduce first Mr. Kilpatrick.
Thank you, Nick. The assigned topic this morning is the American future, which is to say that the assigned topic, in many ways, is pure fun and games, hocus-pocus, hot air, and sheer surmise. It's hard enough to know, truly to know, what happened in the American past, for fact and romance get all mixed up. Those of us in the news business daily perceive that we are only dimly aware, and sometimes not aware at all, of what goes on in the American present. The American future, in many essential respects, is simply unknowable. Back in 1929, President Hoover created a select commission to project a 25-year plan for America. 500 top brains were assigned to that report. They brought in 13 volumes of projections. The summary alone took up 1,300 pages. Yet not one word was predicted about atomic energy, jet propulsion, antibiotics, transistors, television, computers, or many other developments. The best brains of 1929 could not predict Adolf Hitler. They could not foresee Pearl Harbor. The futility of predicting such events is self-evident. If we had gathered a century ago this week, looking at the American future in 1875, a few dreamers might have made good guesses about technological change, but it would have been hit or miss if they had predicted the telephone in 1876, movable typesetting machines in 1885, the automobile in 1887, the airplane in 1896, and the radio on a hit in 1913. Yet the future does hold an abiding fascination. At least since the Oracle at Delphi, men have been trying to push through the unknowable fogs. And, of course, in certain ways, we can make reasonable forecasts about things to come. For example, we can project with reasonable certainty how many kindergarten children will be enrolled in 1980 because these children are already born. We can make a reasonable guess at housing requirements in 1995 because we know pretty well what the market will be at that time. We can make other reasonable projections also, based not upon technological developments or upon known data, but upon certain human relationships and human experience. We can learn, it seems to me, something from the past about the relationship between man and the state, and about the relationship between men and other men. Looking ahead, I would anticipate a great deal more government in America over the next 25 years. This is partly because the trends of the past 50 years have accelerated in recent years and have taken us farther and farther toward the regimented state. The nature of society continues to change, to grow more complex. World interdependence lies ahead of us in increasing degree over the next 25 to 50 years. Certain necessary materials become scarce. In order to continue our production along present lines, we must, it seems to me, make concessions and become more dependent, more interlocked with other nations around the world. I would anticipate an increasing part of our gross national product directed simply to the role of government, government in every way. And as government enlarges, so personal freedom will diminish. So far as the relationships of men and other men are concerned, I see no particular reason to imagine a fundamental change in our character in America over the next several decades. Men will be as greedy, as kind, as charitable, as venal, as men have always been. I would anticipate many gains for women, some gains for other minorities in our present society. I would anticipate no improvement in the quality of life in our great cities. I would anticipate a continuing movement from the great cities on back toward the country. I would anticipate, based upon past swings of the pendulums of mankind, some changes in morality, some turning back to old mores. But in these predictions and in most others, I can be as wholly wrong as the brains of 1929 who could not see truly much past 1930. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jack. Of course, as a conservative, you're really not required to look into the future. The past is your thing. We have, however, in David Halberstam, a man who did make a number of predictions some years ago, and surprisingly enough, they came true. Now, I don't know whether Mr. Halberstam can do it again, but may I welcome you to the podium and hope you can, David.
If what I say today seems to have a certain nostalgia for the past, I do not necessarily revere the good old days. As someone once said, and we are on the eve of the 4th of July, the 4th of July is not now and never was what it used to be. But there is a sense of change in our life, the speed of life accelerating all time. One system of values, be it moral or governmental, a system of order, being increasingly torn apart more by, I think, the coming of modern technology than anything else, and not being replaced as yet by anything else. We have, with television, really in a way, I think, virtually ended the political party system as it exists in this country. The machines have been replaced by ABC, CBS, and NBC, and yet the networks are not really willing, for example, to accept the responsibilities that go with that power. And I think that that is true in many elements of our society. And when we talk about what is happening in America, we are not talking really just about America. We are talking about the Western world. What happens in the Western world happens first here, because we are the most industrialized, the most highly technological of all the societies. Therefore, we're the tripwire for it. But it will happen in Western Germany and in Europe and England and along the way. And it seems to me that a number of things are happening. One, the government, as Mr. Kilpatrick said, is getting more powerful, and it is indeed constantly infringing upon individual liberties and will continue to do that. Our society becomes more complicated, and the speed of life, the complexity of issues, has tended to work over the last 25 years against democracy, against the deliberative bodies, the kind of thing that we herald today, the New England town hall kind of meeting. That works in a very small one-cell model in New England. But now, as issues get more and more complicated, as our demands and expectations rise, the deliberative bodies, the Congress, have been left in the past, and it is the executive branch, with its expertise, with its computers, with its huge staffs, which has come to dominate us. And more, I think we are going to see a society where an executive branch, buttressed by modern technology, by its ability to adapt to the modern speed of life, the increasing velocity, and I mean television, computers, jet age, tends to encroach in all areas of life. And this is not by any means a good thing. Someone once said of the Nixon administration that we had gotten to the point where we had an unwritten electronic amendment to the Constitution with television. It was an administration, indeed, that was brought to you by television. It was put together out of the manipulative arts, J. Walter Thompson. And it does seem to me that the speed has worked against, and more, I think, organs in our life are going to get bigger. Bigger companies, more systems. And the role of the individual, the sense of personal fulfillment, is diminishing. The sense of satisfaction with what you have done each day, that has diminished. And so we are in a kind of a query as we advance towards the end of this century. We have, in some ways, more time on our hands. Our expectations are higher. Our aspirations are higher. Information, television, has made our sense of our possibilities higher. And yet our own sense each day of fulfillment from life is diminishing. And out of that, I think there is a constant sense of frustration, often, in fact, bordering on rage. And as a symbol, it seems to me the great problem for Americans these days, if I were giving a commencement address, which I don't get to do, McGeorge Bundy and Bob McNamara give the commencement addresses in the country. If I were giving a commencement address, I would try and tell young people to find a job where they counted, where there was an element of personal satisfaction, where at the end of a day they would know what they did. And it seems to me that as we get more and more systems, more and more computers, that the sense of personal fulfillment diminishes. And I would name as a symbol of our order a great hamburger chain which dominates our lives, and it serves more and more hamburgers each day to more and more people. Now, the question of whether those are good hamburgers or not is beyond the point compared to an era when I grew up in a small town in Winston, Connecticut, where if you went to a local kind of grill, you got a real hamburger, and the people who served it had a pride in doing it, and everybody was somehow involved in that community. Now we are serving more and more, they are less and less good, and I think probably the people who serve them are getting less and less pleasure out of them, and I think increasingly there will be more and more parts of our life which will have the kind of systems that these hamburger franchises. And there's an old Langston Hughes poem, which I'm very fond of, and it goes very simply, curb your dog, don't let your dog curb you. And I would like for the latter part of the 20th century to amend it slightly and say, curb your machines, Don't let your machines curb you. Thank you.
We now come to the question and answer portion of our program, and I am instructed to request that we have questions of our guests and not speeches. As a matter of fact, there's a little instruction here that says if a crank starts to make a speech, try to cut him off politely. So all you cranks out there, there are microphones on the either side of the hall. There are the cards that you have been given. You may use to write questions if you care to, and the ushers will pick them up and bring them up here, and we'll try to get to as many as we can. Is there an inquiry? If there isn't. There is.
Yes, my name is Eldon Crusell from Washington, D.C. Most of the social welfare programs provide the basic necessities of life for destitute families. However, generation after generation of these families remain on the poverty level and are unemployed. And my question is to the panel, how could these programs be restructured so that in the future many of the unemployed could be brought into the labor market?
The acoustics here are terrible. We are having trouble hearing. If you could hear it, would you answer it?
The gentleman's question, if we could understand it up here, went to public housing and public welfare services, and how can we look ahead in an effort to get many of those who are now on public welfare back in the labor market? Was that the thrust of the question, sir? I'm not certain that I can offer in a brief period any very satisfactory answer to so comprehensive a question. There are now something in excess of 13 million people on our welfare rolls. In San Francisco, one out of seven families is on food stamps. In New York City, it's one out of eight on welfare. The problems of devising a system in which those on welfare are not penalized when they earn money in the private sector is a formidably difficult problem. Now, there have been efforts made, and I think constructive efforts, as in California, to reduce the welfare rolls by cutting down on fraud. Studies have shown from 25 to 40% of the recipients under the Aid to Dependent Children program are not eligible for the level of benefits they've been receiving. I think a good deal could be done about the welfare problem in those directions. Otherwise, I would tend to leave most of the answer to the free economy and to the free market, what remains of it, in an effort to cultivate jobs, honest jobs, productive jobs, and to draw people off welfare and into those jobs. I believe we can reduce these rules over the next 5 years.
Can I just add a footnote of something that puzzles me very much about our society? And I would begin with the assumption that nobody really likes being on welfare. It's not very positive way to come home every night, but we live in a society clearly where our public transportation has badly failed, and if we are to have any kind of conservation of energy resource over the next 20 or 30 years, we have got to desperately and quickly improve public transportation, and in particular things like railroads. And one of the things that we most desperately need is to improve the New York, for example, to Washington Railroad or the Long Island Railroad. And yet, we have the worst road bed in the world. We have enormous unemployment and on welfare. And somehow our society, which can put men on the moon, cannot fix a road bed and cannot translate unemployment through governmental program into fixing a New York to Washington road bed. And I find that a kind of stamp against us, a judgment against us as a society.
I think we have a question over on this side.
My name is Sandy Esserman. I'm from Chicago, Illinois. And Mr. Halberstam, you allude in your speech to the demise of the two-party system. I'd like to hear what Mr. Kilpatrick has to say on that subject.
Well, the two-party system is certainly in trouble. In January, one poll found only 13% of the people identifying themselves as Republicans. Many polls have shown that about 30-odd percent identify as Democrats. Half of all presently registered voters, or very nearly half, identify themselves as independents. So it's manifest that the two-party system is in trouble. It's going to be in deeper trouble, in my judgment, if the country goes the route of direct popular election of presidents. That constitutional amendment has come out of a subcommittee in the Senate, is headed for consideration in the full committee, and probably will pass the Senate this year and go to the House for consideration next year. If we get into direct popular election of our presidents, I think you'll have a proliferation of parties, and the two-party system is going to be in still further trouble. I don't know how you revive it, sir. It served us well for a long, long time, and I personally would like very much to see it revived, but it doesn't look that way right now.
The point I really was making earlier was very simply that it had been part of an old-fashioned community, and people went to the party and went to the party boss because there was a kind of quid pro quo, and it was also a sense of involvement in American life. And for that reason, a candidate running for office needed to deal with the people that way. Now, obviously, he can parachute in over them through television. Who needs to deal with Dick Daley when he can go on the Cup Show and reach 2 million people in Chicago? And as it has no longer has its proper function, candidates don't need it. It has atrophied at every level. And while it was always clearly flawed and it had its imperfections, it has really, in a way, been replaced by nothing. And we are the less for that.
If I could add just one more thought to that. In Mr. Dooley's day in Chicago, the ward precinct people meant something. They could bring you the scuttle of coal in the middle of the winter or the Thanksgiving turkey. They could get your son a job as a motorman on the trolley system in Chicago. All of those functions now have disappeared in terms of the political party. Our public welfare services have taken over the Thanksgiving turkey. Civil service has taken over the motorman's job on the trolley. And the opportunities for a political party either to reward its good workers or to punish those who don't do their job, those opportunities just about gone. The political party is left with fundraising as its main function, and under this new Electoral Reform Act, if it's upheld, at least in presidential elections, that function is going to pretty nearly disappear. The effort's going to be made to extend that act to elections of congressmen and senators, and then again the role of the political party will diminish. I just don't see where the political parties go as I look ahead.
And it gets to the point now where a potential candidate for the presidency of the United States does not have to think in terms of dealing, when he runs, with other professional politicians who have different constituencies. He really instead has to go to a media advisor, a Dave Garth or a Charlie Guggenheim or an H.R. Haldeman for that. And it makes politics, I think, more manipulative. I think it has become more manipulative for that reason.
Could we have a question from this side, please?
My name is Rob Chewy from Uniontown, Pennsylvania, and I'd like to address my question to Mr. Halberstam, and it focuses on what you were saying about getting a sense of satisfaction from a day's work. And I would like to know what your feelings are on the implications of us today of having to try to resolve every problem either through a mathematical equation or through programming a computer. And what are your implications, or what do you foresee as the problems of this?
You're going to have to tell me part of the question. I lost the inner part because of the hearing, the sound.
I was reading the cards.
What are the implications of the computer and these mechanical solutions in terms of problem solving as we lie here?
Well, I have a great abiding distrust of computers. Because they're no smarter than the people who run them, and no more honest than the people who feed them. And there was once a Secretary of Defense who, the United States of America, who thought that they gave answers and they had truth. There was kind of, someone once said that for Bob McNamara, the failure of the computer in Vietnam was like the failure of communism, the failure of Catholicism to previous generation, a God that failed. And, you know, there's a limit of what they can tell you. There's a lovely story as Vietnam was collapsing of a Vietnamese general telling of how the Americans had brought computers as a means of stamping out corruption. And all the Vietnamese generals who were very much on the dole and taking a lot of big money were very upset because suddenly they're going to lose their graft. And then, you know, there was no way of beating the computer on corruption. And finally, one of them figured that all he had to do was buy the people who fed the computers. And they did that, and they could go on being corrupt. And so abiding modern times with olden corruption. The point about that on the big systems, it just seems to me, is that the role of the individual, and I cited a small restaurant or a shop, that was part of a community. It gave the people who ran it a sense of pride, a sense of value, a sense of self-esteem, a sense of linkage to their neighbors, and it made that neighborhood distinctive. What we are seeing more and more is a kind of national attitude, a national computer which can view what marketing tests will be and will indeed look past either regional or differences of taste or attitude, and I think gradually give the people who are part of it, there'll be more and more people who are part of it, and they'll all have less and less pleasure. The machine will dominate, not the individual. And I think it's going to happen. I think you're going to see increasingly over television, not just advertisements for a beer and razor blades, but for clothes and for marketing foods. I mean, all these things, it's all going to get more and more systematized.
Let me, here we have a whole cluster of cards kind of on the same topic. Let me just read them to you, gentlemen, see if you care to talk about any of these things. Mr. Kilpatrick foresaw no improvement in the quality of living in U.S. major U.S. cities. Could you explain your reasons for saying that, please? How does the panel see the energy crisis relating to urban living, i.e., do they see a return to central city living? If not, why not? Mr. Kilpatrick said openly, and Mr. Halberstam implied, the quality of life will not improve. Why? Will there be future racial unrest in the inner cities? Any of that interest you, gentlemen?
I'm perfectly willing to speculate a little bit on the future of the great cities. One of the reasons I think the quality of life is likely to decline or certainly not improve is demonstrated today in New York City, where the trash collectors, the sanitary workers, have gone on strike. The great governmental unions are growing year by year, attaining much more power. It's one of the most fruitful fields, perhaps next to farm workers, in the whole area of organized labor. Well, as your municipal trade unions become more powerful and exert greater influence upon government, I can well imagine that the costs of living in a great city will go to a point where it'll be beyond the reach of a great many families, and then the exodus that we've witnessed in recent years will be accelerated. The quality of life for those that remain is not going to be improved. Secondly, so long as we continue to add 8 or 9 million automobiles net a year to the highways, all of them looking for a place to park, fighting the rush hours morning and night, it seems to me the quality of life's not going to get much better. I see the cities just going up and up, more and more high-rises and condominiums and these little beehive cells where people dwell. This is a quality of life that has no great attraction to me. I just don't see areas in which it's going to improve. But again, I say I can be completely wrong about these things. You see the city life improving?
Well, I'm a person who loves living in a city, and I think there are reasons for it. You obviously give up something, and you hopefully get something back, and you get back, I think, a kind of diversity of community, a sense of options, be it on restaurants or movies or theaters. New York, one of the small benefits is late at night, I happen to be a late night television watcher. I love, there are about 3 or 4 different movies I can watch. And there's that sense of diversity and community, and the sense that when you go out at night to be with friends, you don't really know what you're gonna learn, who you're gonna meet. I mean, it is that sense of possibilities.
Get mugged by.
Well, that's. And which makes you put up with often difficulties. But in defense of New York, It is not, the great problem is not necessarily the coming of huge unions, although that's certainly a symptom of it and a problem. And as the economics of living in the city become more hopeless, the unions become more troubled and more obstreperous. What is, I think, the symbol of the cities is of a general broader racial failure throughout the country, and a generation of young blacks coming up from rural towns in the South, often with almost no educational possibilities there, coming to New York because of welfare programs offered there, who have a terrible time suddenly adapting to a new, modern, highly technological society, who cannot make, as immigrant grandparents did in 60 and 70 and 80, 90 years ago, an immediate adjustment to the society and make a language transition and go to work. I think the society has gotten more complicated, and the gap between the new immigrant, if he comes from Alabama or Georgia, is greater. And that has burdened the city, burdened its tax rolls, its welfare rolls, has made its tax base almost impossible. And the sad thing about New York as a symptom of a city where a lot of people really want to live, want to stay there, is that the economics of it have systematically driven out the middle class, and it now becomes a place where the rich, or the very rich, and the very poor both live, and that is a very combustible situation.
May we have a question from this side of the room, please?
My name is Gerard A. Zam from Arlington, Virginia, and my question is directed to both participants. It has been said that our nation is becoming one of shoddy standards, where mediocrity breeds mediocrity and a striving for excellence is disappearing. Do you agree or disagree with this statement? And if you agree, what societal institution or institutions do you see as the rejuvenating force in this return to standards of excellence?
As a general proposition, of course I would agree with the gentleman's observation. The standards of excellence, it seems to me, have declined within my own lifetime, which is not a very long lifetime. But it seems to me that more products tend to break down. The shoddy merchandise that he talks about is more prevalent, or so it seems to me. But I'm curious from time to time to know whether my perception is accurate. I wonder if there ever has been a time in America when excellence really pervaded our economy. Wasn't Revere silver in the 18th century kind of a luxury item, a quality item, even then? Certainly the ordinary American citizen 150, 200 years ago was not furnishing his dining room with Hepplewhite chairs or beautiful antiques, works of art, and so on. Maybe we are no worse off now than we've been in the past. It seems to me it may be just a consequence of the multitudinous nature of our society, is so many products, so many consumers, so many opportunities for merchandise to go bad. And I suppose if we look around, we still can find the Stuttgart Ballet playing in Kennedy Center, which is about as high a level of excellence as you can get. So the situation may not be as hopeless as it sometimes seems when the toaster won't work and the refrigerator is on the blink and the freezer has just thawed everything inside, and the automobile won't start. There are still areas of excellence, I think.
I would add to that I would agree with much of that, and add that I don't think if it were the alleged good old days, any of us would probably be in this room. You know, I think you'd probably be back having to scratch very hard and for a living and not able to take this trip to Washington. And I think that one problem you talk about, failure of this or that, there are just more and more people who have more and more things, and more people have higher expectations. The number of Americans who would expect to have three or four suits, which means at least one zipper won't work, or the number of Americans who expect in their lifetime to go to college, which means probably the level of college education has gone down, the number of Americans who expect once or twice a week to have a bottle of wine with their meal, the number of Americans who expect to have a car, a boat now. This has meant that more and more people are sharing, there are more and more people really touching a mass, good market, good society. And the level of diet, how well we eat compared to 50 years ago, has gone up. So we are not without being beneficiaries. It seems to me that the balance between satisfaction and fulfillment and self fulfillment is what is, at this moment, given the power of technology, very much threatened in our lives.
Gentlemen, we have a number of questions along the line of one that I'm about to read to you. And I think it may put you a little bit on the spot. It said, this is addressed to Mr. Halberstam, but there are some quite like it to Mr. Kilpatrick. You said that you would advise college graduates to seek a job with personal fulfillment. Other than being self-employed, please name some or even one.
Well, there's an American belief that that you have to go to college, and it's somehow automatically better to be a CPA than a carpenter. I'm not sure about that. I'm not sure about that anymore. I think that anybody who makes a career decision ought to genuinely have a sense not only of what his possibilities are and what he likes, but if it's a flip of a coin between two, think of which one really has more daily personal satisfaction. I cite that because I have friends. I know the community of Nantucket very well now. There's a whole generation of college-educated kids who went to school in the 60s, trained, often some of them with masters and PhDs, who have turned away from the things that they thought they were supposed to do automatically, college education, whatever, and have come back to carpentry and leather working and things that, of great skill and great craft, and have found a considerable amount of pleasure in their lives. And I mention that just idly. I think if someone does not know what will give him satisfaction and in a personal sense, I cannot blindly mention it from this thing, but I think it's self-evident that there are jobs that are indeed things where you do things with your hands and you have some control over your own turf.
Oh, I would certainly echo David's observations there. Where can a man or woman find fulfillment? I've been in the newspaper business all of my life, and most of that I was working for a publisher. I was on payroll, and it was an immensely fulfilling experience for me as a writer. To be a reporter, it's a great thing to be a newspaper reporter. Out on my farm yesterday, a stonemason who works for another man, he's on a payroll, finished work yesterday on a spring house. I know he was fulfilled. He showed off his work with pride. This is pretty much in the character of the person, I believe. If you don't have the capability of being fulfilled, you'll be sour-bellied, dyspeptic all your life and never satisfied. But there are many, many opportunities in our society for fulfillment in your work if you go at it with the right attitude.
Could we have a question from this side of the hall, please?
Barbara Bear, Hanover, Pennsylvania. Mr. Halberstam, in The Best and the Brightest, you spoke of the dangers resulting from an arrogance of power. My question is, first, do you see a similar arrogance developing in the present administration, any part of it, or any other faction in the country? And secondly, do you think there's danger of the opposite situation, a situation in which people and leaders lack confidence in leadership positions?
Could you repeat the first part of the question, which I didn't get?
Is the Ford administration arrogant?
Oh, no. It's the best thing about Ford is a certain modesty to him, a certain essential decency. Whether he is a man, the judgment on him is whether he is tough-minded enough and to handle the extraordinarily complicated problems of the latter part of the 20th century, where, the speed of life and the complexity of issues that confronts a president are so numerous and so demanding. The most attractive part of him is his own personal dignity and decency, his inner security and sense of self, and his belief that the presidency has not confirmed upon him qualities that he did not have before that day. It's a lack of an imperial sense. He does not use the imperial we about the presidency, and he doesn't have the palace guard dressed in Swiss uniforms. And indeed, of course, part of this is the fault of the press. I watched the Cronkite News show last night, and there were at least six clips of Gerry Ford going around town to different meetings. But I think that there is, at least in his level, a decency and a modesty that's very becoming to him, and that's probably the best part of that administration so far. And the second part of the question,
is there a danger of a lack of confidence?
Oh, I think a certain skepticism about your political leadership is a healthy thing. I think that there's a line between skepticism and cynicism, and a certain skepticism after 10 years of being badly governed or of governmental incredibility as opposed to credibility. That's healthy. I think American people are longing to hear the truth and longing to hear modesty and candor. I think a president could say, I made a mistake, either on Vietnam or on Watergate, and his popularity would have gone up 20%. I think that people know the truth when they hear it and will respond. I think that we're all waiting for some modesty and decency in our and humility almost in our leadership. You know, I think we can survive.
I'll let it go, Ted.
Here's a big one for you gentlemen to expatiate on. Analyzing future U.S. foreign commitments into the 1980s, could the panel discuss three main international strategic interests of the United States as you envision it?
David, go ahead. This is his field, not mine. Go ahead.
Oh, it seems to me that obviously the great I think there's a number of problems. Obviously, the Middle East is a constant open sore. The tension between the Arabs and Israelis is going to remain, and particularly now since we as a highly developed Western society are extraordinarily dependent on sources of energy from that area, and since we continue to waste our own energy, that's obviously a problem and has direct domestic repercussions. In the larger sense beyond that, it seems to me that the world doesn't really divide up so much between the communists and the non-communists. I think that I don't want to dissent from Mr. Solzhenitsyn's view because I think, like all Americans, I applaud his passion and his own life symbol. But I think that increasingly the division in the world is between the rich and the poor, and the rich are going to be industrial developed, and that is going to include us and Eastern Europe and the Soviets and the Japanese, and the poor by and large will be non-white, non-developed, and underdeveloped. And I think that's, and issues, things like food are going to become massive political issues. Jim mentioned earlier in the program in his statement about interdependence of nations, and I think that that is something that is with us. I would think that the Rome Food Conference, the fact that poor countries which are starving now because of mass communications know how rich we are instantaneously, and we know how starving they are, makes us, gives us a kind of kinship that we have never had before, and there are going to be responsibilities there.
The interesting thing to me is to see how far we're going in what's been called the new isolationism. This is an attitude that was manifested in the Democratic National Platform at Miami in 1972, echoed at Kansas City in December of last year. It's a drawing back in. It's an unwillingness to involve ourselves militarily, defensively, with old allies, other nations, largely a consequence, I'm sure, of Vietnam. When the dominoes started falling there this spring, first South Vietnam, then Cambodia, now Laos, a sense of panic swept over a good part of the Western world. For the past 3 months, Mr. Ford, Secretary Kissinger, been hustling around the world telling our one-time friends that we were not going to let them down. I think it's a very fine thing for them to have done, but I'm not certain the Congress of the United States that's now constituted is going to back them up. Just looking to the immediate future, what would the reaction be of the American people and of the American Congress to an invasion of South Korea by North Korea? Seriously now, what would the American people do or want done in such a contingency? It may be upon us before we know. I'm an unabashed hawk. I'm about as anti-communist as Mr. Solzhenitsyn, who's the most anti-communist person I ever listened to. And I would have to dissent from David's view on this. As far ahead as I can perceive, the struggle is between those who have an ideal of tyranny, despotism, slavery, call it what you will, the communist world, the communist ideology, and those of us who survive in the Western world with certain aspirations toward human freedom, civil liberties, that will be snuffed out under a communist regime. I don't see any end to that conflict. I don't see any end to it in my lifetime. I see no diminution in communist efforts, communist aggression in one form or another around the world. What I do see is a slacking off in our American resistance to it, our hostility to it, our comprehension of our own freedoms and the dangers to these freedoms that communism represents. And it's this diminution, this slacking off, this complacency that concerns me in foreign affairs as I look ahead.
Sooner or later we're bound to disagree on something. It's all been too tidy up till now, but it does seem to me that you have to be very careful when you talk about human freedom. We've just come out of Vietnam, where the essential problem was that we were following in the footsteps of the French colonial pattern, and the French colonial regime was not known for its freedom to Vietnamese. And I think that the danger of talking about communism as a one and the entire rest of the world as though it were a free world is exactly what got us into Vietnam, that that there are, I think, Western societies which have comparable governments, backgrounds as we do, and where they probably genuinely want an American umbrella. And I see no real isolation coming there. I think we're as deeply involved in the rest of the world now as ever before. In fact, probably more so given the shrinking size of the globe and the American commercial interests in Europe and throughout. But that in no way can you, I don't think we are the policemen of the world. I don't think we can be. I think that indeed is the sure way to weaken us. And I think we have to be very, very careful when we use the word freedom and where it's applicable, because the inability to see Vietnam for what it was, a struggle, a continuing struggle by a Vietnamese nationalist communist movement against a Vietnamese government which was in a sense the legatee or the legacy of a colonial regime, is precisely why American ideals, however well-intentioned, and American servicemen, no matter how brave, failed in Indochina.
Well, let's just wrestle with that. I want to, if I could have just about another 30 seconds on that. The kind of thing that bothers me in our attitude toward Vietnam and toward communism and toward world affairs generally is the attitude that was expressed by most of the liberal elements of our press back in the spring. There came a moment when President Chu, that corrupt, oppressive dictator, president through you, you can't mention his name without those adjectives, when the oppressive, corrupt President Chu closed five newspapers. The entire Eastern press erupted with lamentations and denunciations and reproaches and said, "Wow, how terrible it is that President Chu has closed these five newspapers. Look at this corrupt, oppressive dictator." Well, 3 weeks later, Saigon fell and the communists came in and all newspapers were closed. Now, let's talk a little about freedom in these relative terms. I'm not going to defend the state of affairs in South Vietnam under Chu or in the condition or in the years that immediately preceded the collapse. But freedom's relative. There was a chance there. There was a little candle that was flickering. And now it's out. And I don't hear any cries really of regret from my friends on the liberal side, just kind of a philosophical sigh, well, just let it go. And I don't like that.
My,
well,
Jack.
You're going to get your money's worth after all, because I'm going to respond again. You'll hear some regret from me. You'll hear regret that that we went in, that we did it at all, that we tore ourselves apart, that those of us, journalists like myself, weren't better out there, weren't able to somehow portray it as a way that this country would never have gone on that tragic course. I don't think the liberal press really screamed quite to the degree that Jim says over the closing of those papers. And I would not describe Win Van Chu as a tyrannical, a cruel a dictator. I describe him as a former French corporal, and that's why we lost.
You guys finished having at each other? Shall we get on to the next question?
It's Jim Cummins from Washington, D.C., and my question is directed to both of you gentlemen. In your opening remarks, you dealt mainly with the effects of a large and growing system on the individual. But my question is, what do you see for the future in terms of relationships between groups in the country? In the last 10 years, there's been a lot of talk about the growing polarization between black and white, young and old, rich and poor. Do you feel that this polarization will continue, decrease, intensify, what?
No, you go ahead.
Sure. Wish I could venture a happy and pleasant response to that question. I'm not at all certain that I honestly can. I'm not certain that this polarization is going to diminish over coming years. I said earlier that I believe that women, who of course are not numerically a minority at all, that women will take a larger role in our economy and our public political life. I'm not at all certain where the black minority goes. Racial prejudice has been a condition of mankind for thousands upon thousands of years. We've done much, I think, in recent years to improve the economic life of a great many American blacks, the social political life as well, of course. And yet, I look around the country and I don't see, perhaps my perception is wholly wrong, I don't see the signs of total integration of black and white that would mean an end to this polarization. I look at Boston, where racial tensions have been exacerbated. I read about these affirmative action programs in various institutions of higher learning and in industry. And I see the tensions that had been going down coming back up again. I'm not certain at all that some of the efforts that are being made now in the name of civil rights aren't proving counterproductive, if they aren't reviving tensions that were beginning to go away. So I don't look, honestly, for too much improvement in the near future in this unhappy situation.
It seems to me that it's a symbol of the particular error and the anger and the kind of explosiveness, and that, I suppose, hope or believe that eventually that people will be able to deal with each other at a human level and find out who they are, and race will mean less and less. But even in the areas of our society which are most thoroughly and legitimately integrated, the United States Army, professional sports, there is a tendency there, even at a social level, to have polarized relationship in the year 1975. Now, that may very well change 20 years from now, and we may know more about each other, and we may be less polarized. But for the moment, at least, that is where we stand. It's not a very happy thing. It's not a very attractive thing, but it's probably understandable, given our 200-year history.
Hey, we have a question from this side, please.
My name is Blood. I'm from Cleveland, Ohio. And my question is for anyone who would like to chance it. Don't you feel that television in the 60s have educated the average American to the point where they realize and know that they can get more back from the government through their cities or states, that there is or are monies available, and that there is going to be a considerable settling influence in 76, when we have elected leaders in the two most important or the highest offices in the land? Is there going to be a settling influence? More so, are people going to be able to relate to people that they have put in office, not that has been put in office for them by circumstances? Is it going to be a calmer and more educated country?
Oh. I thought the thrust of your question was going off in a somewhat different direction about the education of the American people and the idea that they could get something back from Washington. If I understood you correctly, I would venture this observation, that the money that comes back that is referred to as federal aid or federal grants is money that's taken from the people in the first place. It's not the federal government's money. It's the people's money. And it comes back to the states and the localities very unevenly. New York City, for example, is on the wrong end of this thing. New York contributes far more to the federal government than it ever gets back in grants back to the city and state. So, but if I understood the last part of your question, and again, we must apologize up here, the acoustics in this hall may be wonderful if you're singing opera, but when you're trying to field questions, it's almost impossible to make them out. I think certainly that the election of 1976 will have a legitimizing effect upon the presidency. There is a residual cynicism, I suppose, about Mr. Ford and Mr. Rockefeller, neither one of whom has been elected nationally to his office. Yes, in 1976, I think certainly we stabilize, settle back down. We will have a fully accredited administration in the old-fashioned sense. And I would think this would be a good thing for the political life of our country.
Yes, I think to the degree which Mr. Ford is challenged both within his party and in the Democratic Party is a very positive thing and very healthy. And I would assume that 76 could be a very exciting year. I think that the issues would be defined and, you know, that some of the real currents of America debated, although that has not really been done. A presidential election at its best is really a national forum. The candidates learn about the country and hopefully the country learns about the issues. That very little of that has happened in the last 12 years. There's been a great obscuring, I think, of issues. On what television it done, just because we've had almost a decade now, a little bit more, of a national television hookup of a half-hour news show, which seems to me to have changed the country radically, politically, and I think it has meant a rising level of intelligence, knowledge most of America is getting for the first time in its life, a good front page, which is something quite new most places, particularly west of the Appalachian Mountains. A lot of places just weren't a good newspaper, and now the Chancellor or the Cronkite Show, this is a good, but it raises more questions than it explains, and it trivializes. It does some things awfully well, but with 22 minutes, it's like trying to put the New York Times on a postage stamp. There's an instinct to trivialize, and sometimes I think it's almost that it raises our tensions and doesn't answer things. It doesn't explain. It's like pitching live grenades into our homes, and that's the way it is, and the evening is over. And I wish they would go deeply to a little bit longer a show to explain more, to give us a sense of some continuity. They always said of the evening news show that if they were handling Moses coming down the Ten Commandments, they say, Moses today came down with the Ten Commandments, the two most important of which are, you know.
We are approaching the end of our anointed hour, but let's see if we can take one or two more questions. Could we take a question from that side of the hall?
Yes, I'm Kent Myers. I'm a futurist here in town professionally, and I'd recommend it as good work for young people. But I'd like to ask Mr. Kilpatrick, you say we're getting less sure of ourselves. Well, I would suspect that's because we don't have any goals. You keep talking about freedom, and that's kind of a context for doing good things, but you don't put out in front of us what we should work for, and that's kind of what a futurist would criticize your comments about. You talk about surmise in the future. Well, that's what you do, but unless you have some sort of vision of where you're going to, you're not going to get there. You're just going to respond and, you know, project, feel what's going to happen. Okay. So could you tell us what your goals are rather than just, you know, personal greed or freedom?
My goals are all tied up in personal freedom, and I'm not certain I can define them in any broad sense in any other way. If you want to know what my goals are, what kind of society would I like to see ahead? A more decentralized society in which the decision-making power, the key decision-making power, more and more rested with people in their communities, their cities, counties, within their states. There was less and less effective decision-making at the national level by the great executive agencies of Washington. I would like to see people free to make their choices in the broadest areas of education of their children, in the choice of media, the information they get, the kind of lifestyles they want to live. And my fear is that this freedom of individual action is diminishing year by year. My goals are to try to restore these areas of individual and community action, to bring them back to let people live as they want to live in freedom from government harassment and regimentation, looking after their neighbors, not harming or damaging them, their neighbors, but living their own lives more and more in ways that we're not permitted to live them now. Now, those are broad goals, but they're certainly old goals for a nation that's about to celebrate its bicentennial.
I think we have time for one more question on this side of the hall.
Jim Morriston from Fort Worth, Texas. I'd like to return to foreign affairs for a minute. I'd like to know if you see a coalescing between the Western democracies and the communist bloc countries. In other words, do you see the Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact becoming more like the United States in economic system and political liberties, and likewise the United States becoming more socialized and more like the Eastern European countries?
Well, I'm a great believer in as much trade with the Eastern Bloc as possible, and I would regret any failure, for example, in the Soviet wheat deal. And I mean that for a very real reason, and that is, to the degree that we are involved with them, it becomes sources of oxygen in Eastern Europe that are outside the lines from Moscow, and you begin to move them west, and you begin to make them diversify, and you begin to open them up. I always feel very strongly that we could open our society to inspection from them very openly without anything lost. They would fear very much a comparable opening to us. A free tourism there threatens them much more than it threatens us. And to the degree that they become dependent upon us, the more they see of us, the healthier it is for us, the healthier for them. And that any failure along this line is a tragedy. I suppose that when you talk about the coming of a big, modern super state, which is what we've really been talking about here, the state armed with computers and expertise and powers, moving into the vacuums of local government and Congress, you're talking about a phenomenon throughout the modern world, and they're going to have that problem just as much as we are. I assume one of the interesting things about their economy is that it doesn't work, and the whole Czech rebellion experience, Dubček of 65, began with a knowledge in that most sophisticated and advanced of the communist nations, Czechoslovakia, that their economy didn't work, that did not fulfill, it didn't make the pants the people wanted to wear or the shoes, and they had to have much more local autonomy and much more of a kind of market system. Well, that's been temporarily slowed down in Czechoslovakia, but I think there's an inevitability of it. I don't think that the communist nations are going to be year by year, generation by generation, imposed upon their young people the kind of regimentation that they did in the early years when it was immediate post-revolution, and they could say, look how hard we fought against the czars, and you have to trust Mother Russia. I think they have many more problems than we do, I think, in dealing with an increasingly cynical youth. One of the great things about this country is the extraordinary capacity to be reborn, the social fluidity of this society, the capacity to change. What is striking about them is how static they are. They don't have the future. I don't know that we do, but we have a capacity to adapt and still change.
Back.
When Mr. Solzhenitsyn, of detente, it was detente which allowed the Western reporters to stay in the Soviet Union and not be expelled by a government that would have loved to expel them, and which therefore allowed Mr. Solzhenitsyn to have a hearing in the West. They became almost his personal news service in a way. And it is indeed that came out of detente. His inability to silence came out of those much despised Western correspondents.
Nick, I certainly don't want to wind up on any pessimistic note, but in my own observation, it seems to me the drift is far more from west toward east than it is from east toward west. That is to say, in certain economic areas, I perceive a greater trend toward nationalization of industries in our society, the railroads, for one example, than I perceive indications of growing capitalism in the Soviet Union. In terms of civil liberties, I note that Solzhenitsyn was expelled. Recently, the Soviet Union authorized a tiny little art show in Moscow, and it made headlines around the world. It was a poor, feeble little flicker of freedom for the creative artist, but that's all we've seen so far in the Soviet Union. There's not the slightest indication of due process of law, that sort of Western ideal, developing within the communist closed society. Meanwhile, on our Western side of it, I look around and I see everywhere invasions of privacy. We read daily about computer interfaces and computers that talk to computers. And one of the stories that a good investigative journalist could work on is the role of these police computers that talk to each other all around the country in the name of law enforcement. I perceive great dangers to individual liberty in these data retrieval systems, the kind of thing that they have in a closed communist society. So, as I say, I don't want to wind up on a pessimistic note. I believe that there are more indications that we drift in the direction of not totalitarianism and not socialism, quasi-socialism, but the drift is in those general directions, more so on our part than I believe the drift of the communist world is towards civil liberties, capitalism, and those features that are distinctively Western or American.
I have two questions here for you, gentlemen, that you don't have to answer this time, but when you return the next time. The first is it possible at this late date to stop 1984? And the second is, don't you see anything good in our current society? In the meantime, I want to thank both Mr. Kilpatrick and Mr. Halberstam and you all in the audience for taking part in this town meeting. The next national town meeting will be held here in the Opera House next Wednesday, July 9th, and the principal participants will be Senator Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Congressman Philip Crane of Illinois, Jerry Wirth of the State, County, and Municipal Employees, and Mr. W.J. Usry of the Department of Labor. The topic will be, should federal, state, and local employees have the right to unionize?
Thus, the conclusion of this national town meeting. The topic was the American future. The principal speakers were commentator James J. Kilpatrick and author David Halberstam. The moderator was columnist Nicholas von Hoffman. This is Josh Dorsey speaking to you from the Opera House of the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts. Technical director for this broadcast has been Gary Henderson. The funds for this program have been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.